Today's Teisho is on Case 37 in the Book of Serenity. Case 37 is entitled Guishan's Active Consciousness. Introduction: driving away the plowman's ox, pulling its nose around, taking away the hungry man's food, holding his throat tight. Is there anyone who can administer the poison? Case: Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said, all sentient beings have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I call him, hey you. If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, not only is there active boundless consciousness, not only is their active consciousness boundless and unclear, but they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. Verse, one call and he turns his head. Do you know the self or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that. The child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destitution, has such sorrow. Well, I want to thank everybody for doing such an excellent job this morning in Zazen. Everybody was sitting very deeply. It was quite exciting when new people arrived last night for the weekend. I was so happy to see all of you were able to make it to Sesshin, to this autumn Sesshin. Today is like the perfect fall day. It's rainy, the leaves have turned color, they're falling off a tree, it's a little dark. This is like the perfect day for Zazen this morning. Listening to the rain, it's relatively easy to enter deep samadhi if we're not too bothered by our inner conflicts. But even if we are troubled by our inner conflicts, sitting here and listening to the rain gradually lifts us to a deeper, more integrated awareness. So it was a great opportunity for all of us to practice deeply this morning. This koan is quite important. I actually recommend that if you have a few spare dollars, you buy the two Zen classics and you also buy the Book of Serenity. And when you hear koans, you might later, you know, make a note and go home and read them. It won't really do any good to study them academically, but it does help sometimes to know the koan. And this one, I think, is really quite important. Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said all sentient beings have active consciousness, how would you know that might be true? And basically, Yangshan says, you know, if you just call somebody, they'll turn their head without even thinking, and that's active consciousness in action, basically. You might wonder, well, what is active consciousness? This is really quite important. Yesterday, I was talking a little bit about how beautiful it is to enter into the great stillness that opens up when we've been in samadhi for a while. So usually when people come to Sesshin, they're in a state of agitation because so much in our culture encourages nervousness, fear, competitiveness, envy, and so on. There's very little sometimes that is reassuring about our society. And sometimes our workplaces are not hospitable places to be. sometimes we get caught up in tied up in knots in our relationship, you know. I had a friend of mine recently who adopted two children from Central America. And as far as I can see, he's a very nice man. You know, he taught in the writing program for many years. He's a retired high school teacher. His wife, for many years, was a secretary in the English department. And I've always found them to be really wonderful people. But his older daughter began to behave in ways that were very aggressive, and he took her to a therapist, and she even threatened him and his wife. It became so troubling to him. He raised this child. He adopted a child because he and his wife couldn't have children, so far as I can see, he tried to be a good father, and his wife tried to be a good mother, and somehow the daughter began to exhibit signs of really, you know, psychological disturbed psychology. And this caused him endless agony, you know. Naturally, he thought that he probably made some kind of mistake in raising her. And so he was very, very troubled for a long time. And I think these things can happen in life. You know, we can have these experiences that, you know, if we turn, you know, I mean, basically Bob was the man's name. You know, Bob finally had to get a court injunction against his adopted daughter so that she wouldn't threaten him in his home, you know. And, you know, doing that was like heartbreaking for him. Not doing it was heartbreaking for him. So we can get caught in these double binds, in these situations where we can't find a way out, and we just go around and around in a circle. So, you know, when we come to Sesshin, we may be spinning around in our heads in some of these circles, you know. And it's really deliverance. It's really a kind of astonishing fact that you can come here and do Zazen for a couple of days, and all of those troubles begin to recede, and their power over you begins to diminish. And you begin to enter this extraordinary deep stillness, this deep immovable calm. And I had the most wonderful sit this morning in this deep immovable calm. And other people have come into the Dokusan room and said, you know, this is so healing to be here because my life is troubled in this way or that way. And sometimes I think I'll never be able to get back to this place, you know, where, and now I'm there, and there's this wonderful calm, this wonderful safety, and I feel so connected listening to the wind and so on. And this is really amazing, right, that this exists, that such a path as this exists, that in the middle of great distress, it's possible to settle the mind. And when the mind is really calm and really feels safe, this sense of connectedness begins to grow and grow. And it's one of the things that can make Sesshin so delightful, is that, you know, basically you hear the wind and now it feels, it's just this beautiful sound. And you can become one with the wind, the sound of the rain, become one with the rain. And in that mind, in that state of mind, the whole world seems to be part of our own bodies, part of ourselves, and a wonderful place to be. You know, it's just a wonderful place to be. This is really not an illusion. It's the way things really are. You know, everything is one life. And when we are calm and safe, experience that one life, sometimes very powerfully. Maybe you don't think about it consciously, but you might just feel pretty darn happy sometimes at Sesshin. And this is why. It's like being natural once again, you know. Not the mind that is fearful and that gets into these loops, it begins to quiet down, and there's this other mind that's connected, trusting, unobstructed. And being there is like being in heaven, really, you know. It takes a little work to get there. It usually takes a couple days and you know, pain in your legs and so on. But when you find that deep, immovable stillness, it's really wonderful. And anybody who has done Zen for a while knows that this is really quite a gift. You can be distressed day after day after day, and you can sometimes feel like there's no hope. You know, there's no way out of my knots, of my... it's like being in a maze, and you can't find a way out. And every day is stressful. You know, this is quite common for human beings. So to be able to come here and drop these worries and be present in the moment without any obstructions is really precious. So having said all that, there's this other issue, though. You know, there's this other issue. You could be very calm, and you could be gradually healing as you come to Sesshin, you know. And you could feel like $1 million. And then you could get into your car and you could drive back to your home, somebody could, you know, maybe you don't have Easy Pass, and you come up on the Turnpike toll, on the Garden State Parkway toll, and you suddenly realize, oh, I need to put in 50 cents. And then you look down and you realize, wait, I don't have 50 cents. You know, and you have to open, maybe there's a console next to your driver's seat, and you have to dig down inside and get your 50 cents. And you're waiting in line, and all of a sudden somebody starts honking at you, right? It's like you were mellow and happy, and everybody was connected, and now some guy is honking at you, putting pressure on you to move forward. Doesn't he know you don't want to spend 15 minutes at the toll booth? You know, obviously something's going on, right? You're not asleep. But he's not considerate. And then you get back, and maybe somebody's impolite to you. You know, years ago I used to go up to Washington, New Jersey. We used to have a little sitting group up there, there was a man in the house across from the house where we used to sit, and he absolutely did not like anybody to park in front of his house. And I didn't know this, and I parked in front of his house, and he came out, and he really was abusive to me, you know. And so I moved my car, you know, and I thought, that is the strangest thing. But we all encounter these kinds of events, and then maybe you get to work, and maybe your work environment is not very supportive, you know, and you feel pressure mounting, you know. You're at your job, and the deadlines are coming up, and maybe people are not very considerate, and you can begin to feel this sense of pressure or tension. And you can say to yourself, what happened to my beautiful calm? You know, what happened to my beautiful peace of mind? You know, and you might find yourself getting nervous again, and agitated, maybe even angry, and then you might get home on a Friday night and think about Sesshin and, you know, think, you know, was it all a dream, that peace, you know, that connectedness? This is really an interesting question, isn't it? Because there seem to be two different states of mind, you know. On the one hand, there's this state of mind which is very still, very calm, very connected, compassionate, you know. And then there's this other state of mind, which, by the way, we call, early Buddhists called nirvana. You know, when you're, you know, I mentioned yesterday, somebody told me that his morning sit was like paradise. He said, I just had the sit of the Sesshin. He said it was absolutely paradise. And basically, that the early Buddhists understood that. They said, oh yeah, that's nirvana, right? That's wonderful. But you're in nirvana, and then you get in your car and you drive back, and somebody yells at you because you're taking too long at the turnstile. It says, move on. Go on, asshole. You know, it's like, I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but if you live in New Jersey, it will, you know. I'm an asshole because I stopped, you know, at the turn. Okay, I guess so, you know. Or you go into this, you get into a store and somebody just, you know, somebody behind the counter glowers at you, you know, and they're ringing up your groceries, like they're mad at you, like you've done something wrong. It's, I don't even know this person. Why is he mad at me or why is she mad at me? But you can just feel the hostility, you know. And you can get to work and maybe somebody is dumping on you or something, or there's office politics, and you go home and you're really stressed and tense, and it could get really bad, you know. I mean, things can get really, really terrible, you know. I have to say that this last 3 years, my wife and I were taking care of my father-in-law, who was quite ill. And it was very hard work, you know. He required a lot of care. You know, as soon as you get up in the morning, you have to go take care of him. And we loved him, you know. But it was a lot of care. I remember one. You know, sometimes he was his faculties were intact pretty much until the end. He was 90 years old and. But he would fade out just toward the end. And so, you know, he was walking, he would just walk across the floor and he would suddenly just take a pee, you know. And Barbara would, you know, say, Dad, you're peeing on the floor, you know. And it was like he denied it, or, you know. And, you know, then we'd have to clean up the pee, you know. And then she said, you're going to have to wear a diaper, you know. And he said, I'm not wearing any diaper, you know. You know, he was a very macho guy who liked to hunt, and he wasn't going to wear any darn diaper, you know. And so, you know, it actually creates tension when this guy could pee at a moment's notice, you know. And you have guests over, and you're just hoping, oh my God, I forgot to, you know. And this is Jack, you know. Hello, Jack. You know, would you like to pee for the guests, you know? So, you know, there's this element, and you just never know, right? And at the same time, in my job, there was a person who has a very unhappy life, who created a huge civil war in my department, and he made everybody profoundly miserable, you know, I'm working overtime, taking care of my father-in-law, and meanwhile, my work environment was really deteriorating because of this very unhealthy person in our department, creating a lot of unhappiness, really acute unhappiness. And then other things were going on too, and it's just like sometimes it can seem that no matter where you turn, you're blocked, right? You know, I've got to take care of my father-in-law. I can't change my job. I can't, you know, this guy, I can't have him assassinated, you know, so that's not going to work. How am I going to, I can't solve any of my problems, right? And yet all of these are like occasions for distress or suffering, you know. And so, you know, you can get up in the morning and, you know, just the very prospect of suffering creates suffering, right? The very thought that you might, you know, the very thought of tension creates tension. The very thought of suffering creates suffering, you know. So it's like it could be a bleak day after day. And this is samsara, right? Samsara. And the early Buddhists understood samsara and nirvana as opposites. And they said, don't go into samsara, go into nirvana, right? It seemed obvious, right? You know. And that it just seemed like a good idea to them, right? So basically, their idea, you know, and they would, you know, you would say, but look, you know, how do I get out of samsara? You know, I'm so unhappy. And then they would say, well, first of all, you have to be a monk or a nun, right? Part of your suffering is the way you're living. So come to Sesshin for good. See, for good. problem solved, right? And in fact, you know, in many ways, they're right. You know, in many ways, they're right. You know, if you lived this way every day, you would be, you know, if you had a great sit this morning, you'd have a great sit every morning. You know? So there's a point to that. You know, their own experience bore this out, right? They would sit in zazen and great serenity and connectedness, and people would come into the temple and say, I am so miserable. And they'd say, what did you expect? Right? Look at the way you live, you know? Yeah. And this seemed very compelling to them, right? And they would say, if you are out in the world, you know, you're competing too. If you compete, you're going to lose sometime. And then you suffer, you know? If you know, you're buying things, you know, you buy a nice house, the property value plunges, you're in over your head, you know, that's the game you chose to play, you know. So basically give up all possessions, et cetera, come and join us in the monastery, and you will be a happier person. And, you know, you cultivate this deep calm and problem solved. And indeed for them, problem is solved. But there's a larger, complicated matter here, which is, well, what about, what kind of universe is it where there's nirvana and there's samsara? It's like, then it's not an undivided universe, is it? It's not oneness at all. There's two universes. There's a good universe and there's a bad universe, right? This sounds familiar, doesn't it? You know, So basically there's this one good realm, and you should go there and shun the bad realm. But you say, well, what kind of, you know, so that's not a unified mind, right? That's a divided universe. So you're constantly trying to avoid certain kinds of experiences in order to have other kinds of experiences, see? So don't go to samsara, go to nirvana. So you have to avoid all kinds of potentially samsaric activities, potentially samsaric thoughts, potentially samsaric... You see this? You can see where this is going. It creates a divided mind, not a unified mind, actually. And so at some point, there were people in the Buddhist community who noticed this. And said, well, how, you know, basically the Buddha didn't teach that the Buddha didn't say, you know, there's a good world and there's an evil world, and so on. He didn't say any of those things, you know. He talks about, he doesn't make that distinction. And so they said there must be something wrong with this way of thinking. There must be something wrong with this way of thinking because it produces a kind of paranoia about reality. So basically, the Mahayana begins with this question or a kind of dissatisfaction with this way of thinking. And it says, there can't be two universes, a good one and a bad one. Because how did the bad one ever come into existence, right? And so, you could say, well, there's God and there's the devil. But then you say, well, how did the devil come into existence, right? I mean, well, God created the devil. Well, you know, why would he do that? That's not a satisfactory argument either, you know. The Mahayana people said there must be something wrong with the way we're experiencing things, with the way we're thinking about this problem. That there can't be a world of calm and a world of when we enter deep samadhi and we enter this deep calm and we have this profound sense of connectedness, you know, that's real. We get there. But what about this world of craziness and change and so on and so on? Now, if you sit down on the cushion and you begin to watch your breath, you will grow calmer and calmer and calmer. And you might have many psychological obstacles that prevent this from happening, you know. You might have a lot of agitation. You might have obsessive thinking. You might have addictions, you know, including addiction to certain kinds of thought patterns, you know. But sooner or later, if you practice zazen, your mind is going to become still and you'll experience this deep stillness, this deep immobility. But you know, the deepest form of this is in mushin. If you go into deep mushin, everything will disappear more or less. And if you're in really deep mushin, you might not even notice sound. Everything might disappear. Now, it's interesting. This is quite an important fact that the Buddha himself, when he describes his awakening experience, does not say that enlightenment is to be found in deep mushin. This is very important. The founders of the Mahayana, the great brothers, half-brothers, Asanga and Vasubandhu, said this too. They said, look, it's essential to be able to enter deep mushin, but in deep mushin, people cannot become enlightened. This is very important. If you don't enter deep mushin, you can't become enlightened. But if you enter deep mushin, you can't become enlightened just through that experience. Mushin has to turn, you have to turn from mushin back into the realm of form, and then you will have your enlightenment experience. The Buddha had his enlightenment experience when he noticed the morning star. So from the formless back into the realm of form. This is very important. If you are sitting in the deepest mushin and you have the greatest stability, calm, spacious mind, absolutely peace, absolutely unchanging, you'll notice that nevertheless, there's something stirring in that emptiness. There's something stirring. It's like you're in peace, you're in great stillness. But then all of a sudden you'll notice that there's a kind of energy or pulsing. Try it and see. And basically, there's a kind of pulsing or energy in that emptiness. And if you stay with that pulsing or energy, you can begin to feel very... It's like when people are doing the Mu Koan, at first, first, they don't encounter the emptiness. They're looking for the emptiness. Then they encounter the emptiness, see? But they encounter the emptiness, but it just seems like a dead void for a long time. This can take years. You can be in the dead void for a long time. But then, you know, all of a sudden, sometimes people become energized. They might not even consciously know it. You know, they come into the Dokusan room. You know, I did Mu Koan for 3 or 4 years. I can't remember now, but it was a long time. And I would go into the Dokusan room, and sometimes I couldn't even open my mouth. I felt so paralyzed. And sometimes I would open my mouth, but it would just be like moo. It was just like a dead moo. One day I went in and I opened my mouth, and this voice said moo. You know, in a very full, uninhibited way. And it shocked me. It really shocked me. And my teacher started laughing, you know, with happiness, you know. And it was totally uncontrived, because I had already given up. I thought, I'll never answer the Mu Koan. It was happening in our temple up in the mountains. And I remember there was a lightning storm before the sun came up. And there was actually a fire on the mountain next to us, and later that day. But I went to Dokusan early in the morning, and I had no expectations. I just opened my mouth, and it was like this moo came out, you know. And I was so surprised. It was like, did I do that? Basically, it was like I was unconsciously tapping into this energy. But you can even tap into it in a way consciously. You'll notice that in the middle of this stillness, there's a kind of energy. There's something stirring inside you, or there's something stirring. And you can, if you don't fight that energy, if you go with that energy, it can build and build. What we call samsara is really arising from that stillness. And even though it looks crazy to us, it's actually a manifestation of this primal stillness. This sounds very fancy and philosophical. But there aren't two worlds. There aren't two worlds. Everything is Buddha nature. Everything is a manifestation of this fundamental, we call it stillness. But it's so when we look at the world and it seems to be menacing or threatening, we're still separating ourselves from it. We need to unify ourselves with the moment as it's arising, without judgment, which takes great trust. Right, but when we do this, we participate in the creativity of the universe itself. See, and this feeling of like active, there's a kind of total stillness which is mu. That's mu. But there's another kind of mu which is active mu. Active mu. When you open your mouth and you call, and something comes out. This is the active manifestation of that energy, of that great stillness. And these are two aspects of the same reality. They're two manifestations of the same reality. It's like the trough of the wave is that empty stillness. And the wave is the motion of that empty stillness in the world of form. And if you are not afraid, if you don't pull back, but you unify yourself with the moment, you can ride the waves, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful experience. You know. So basically, a number of years ago, came to Rutgers, and I fought very hard to get tenure. I had to work very, very hard. Rutgers is a very competitive place. is so competitive. When I got to Rutgers, the chairman of the department called me into his office, and he said, "This is a very competitive place." And he said, "If when you come up for tenure in 5 years, if you don't have a book, 3 refereed articles, and some book reviews, you're out of here." And I was out of his office, right? And basically, one of my friends, a woman named Nancy, she went into this and got the same talk. And he said, "You better have a book, 3 articles, some book reviews, or you're out of here." And she went home and sobbed because it was terrifying. It's like, what kind of a pep talk was that, you know? It was like the clock is ticking and we're going to chop your head off in 5 years, you know. So it was terrifying, right? You know, but you know, if you pull back from that, if you pull back, you paralyze yourself. You know, if I just kept reminding myself that everything is helping me to wake up, you know. And so basically, you know, instead of thinking I've got to write this article or I'm not going to get tenure, you'd have to sit down and say, this is a chance for me to discover something about the world, you know. This is a chance for me to be in contact with the world in a new way. And it really worked. It worked, you know. I remember I would read these books that had been so difficult for me in the past, but suddenly they were like helping me. You know, they were like helping me. After I got tenure, I was so tired, and the dean asked me to take over this program that was in real trouble. And I was so tired that I would get home at night, and I would sit down at about 6:30 in the evening, or maybe probably 8. And I would sit down on the couch, and I would just go straight to sleep. I was just wiped out. And the dean wanted me to take over this new program that was in so much trouble. And I actually said to him, "Please, I'm so tired. Can't you give this to somebody else?" And he laughed and said, "No." Okay. So, you know, I could have gone. And by the way, the place was a madhouse. It was a civil war going on in there. Nobody got along with anybody else. Nobody would give me a straight answer about anything. They wanted me to fail. You know, they resented an outsider coming in. It was just a nightmare. Okay. However, you know, I could have gone every day and said, "I'm going to fail at this. Everybody's going to look at me and they're going to say, 'There, what a loser,' you know." Or I could have said, you know, "I hate these people, blah, blah, blah." But instead, it's like everything is helping me wake up. This is helping me to wake up. This is helping me to wake up. This is a chance. This is like the doors opening up in the world. And it worked. It works. Everything is helping me to wake up. You know, everything. It's like when you look at the little picture, it seems like a terrible situation. But when you step back, you realize, you know, I'm going to connect with this. I'm going to connect with this. And so as soon as we pull back, as soon as we have this experience of withdrawing, it creates a boundary. It creates a separation. It creates a paralysis and distress, psychological distress of powerlessness. But we can, instead of retreating, we can embrace the moment. You know, you lean into the moment. You go with the moment. So, you know, taking over this program was not something I wanted to do. I was tired, but I decided this is a chance for me to be creative. This is a chance for me to learn something more. This is a chance for me to manifest my Buddha nature. Yeah. And this is like training. There's training on the cushion and there's training off the cushion. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, we trust the process because we believe it's, you know, we know it's taken us to a good place. So we sit down on the cushion, we watch the breath, and we trust the process. But when we're in the world of form, we don't always trust the process, right? Because we think this is going to be a disaster. This is going to be. But we don't. If we sat down on the cushion with that mindset, we'd never get anywhere. If you came in and sat down on your cushion and said, "Oh, brother, this is going to be a disaster," right? I mean, we have moments where we think, "I'll never answer my koan," right? There are those moments of negativity, but we still get back to the cushion because we trust the process. So basically, you know, when you're working with say, mu, and you enter that stillness, you know, that's beautiful, but you have to have the active dimension too. So you have to go, you know, it's interesting that people, mu koan doesn't just involve coming in and telling me about the blankness. You know, you can come in and say, "My God, my mind went totally blank." And the mu koan doesn't say, "Okay, good, you've passed." Then the teacher says, "Great, I want you to call mu, I want you to manifest this with your own body." And you might think, "What the hell?" Right? And then you think, "I'll never be able to do this," right? There's no trust in the process. But then you come in and you call mu, 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 mu. One day, you trust the process enough for something to happen, right? And it's like that in life. It's like, trust the process. There's a, see, people, you know there is a process on the cushion. You know it. But there's a process off the cushion too. And that's what we don't trust. See, there's a process off the cushion too. See? And if you can bring the same trust to your actions off the cushion that you can to your practice on the cushion, so wonderful things can happen. You know. Another way to come at this is like this. Even, you know, those people who started the Mahayana, Asanga and Vasubandhu, made a great discovery, which is that there's this active dimension to emptiness. This is something they discovered probably on the cushion that the Buddha had already taught. But there's another dimension too to this, see. Just as there are not two universes, a good one and a bad one, there aren't two Kurts, a good Kurt and a bad Kurt. See, sometimes you might think there is a bad Kurt, and he's the one who didn't pass you on the koan. But actually, there aren't two Kurts. Or you might think there's a good Ray and a bad Ray. And the good Ray is the one who gets straight A's, and the bad Ray is the one who doesn't. Or the good Bill is the one who says the right thing, and the bad Bill is the one who says the wrong thing in public, you know. So just as we look at the universe as divided, we look at ourselves as divided, and that creates a divided mind, right? We don't trust the process off the cushion because we don't believe there's a process, but there is a process. Okay. We don't trust ourselves either because we don't trust ourselves either. We create a divided self. There's a good Kurt and a bad Kurt. And what I must do is get rid of the bad Kurt and stick with the good Kurt. See? The Mahayana people said that's got to be mistaken too. There isn't an evil Kurt and a good Kurt. Right? You couldn't even imagine enlightenment if there wasn't something in you that was already, you couldn't even imagine enlightenment if there wasn't already in you something which is enlightened. See, this is very important. How could humans have ever invented the idea of enlightenment, you know, if it wasn't already present, if it wasn't already fundamentally part of our consciousness? Our natural state is connected, trusting, and so on. So basically, the Mahayana, after Asanga and Vasubandhu, there was this other teacher whose name is Ashvaghosa, who wrote something called The Awakening of Faith, which is, when we recite the verses on the heart-mind, that's sometimes translated as the verses on the faith mind. But basically, Ashvaghosa said, at the heart of your being is enlightened consciousness. And it's trying all the time to help you wake up. See? We don't believe that in ourselves there's a consciousness which is infallibly guiding us towards enlightenment. You can say, but I make so many mistakes. I screw up so often. We don't trust the process of the self either. But part of Zen practice off the cushion is learning to trust that core intelligence. It's an unconscious intelligence. There's an unconscious core which is already enlightened. And it's guiding you as you move through your life. So part of Zen practice is learning to enter that deep stillness. Part of Zen practice is learning to trust the process off the cushion. And part of Zen practice is learning to trust your true nature. True nature isn't a metaphor. At the heart of your consciousness, there's like a little guide. There's like a little guide who's helping you to wake up. At the heart of your mind, this is how you answer your koans, right? You learn how to tap into the little guide who is helping you to wake up, right? We say big mind. Inside your mind is big mind, yeah, and it's helping you to wake up day and night. I'll wrap this up, but even people who have, like, say, neurotics, people who are neurotic, or people who have personality disorders, you know, you can say, well, what about them? You know, they've been screwed up by their own minds, right? You know, but it's really not true. Even like depression, you know, depression is so frightening. But, you know, I was reading this article that said depression is the mind's way of trying to protect you. It's the unconscious's way of trying to protect a person from stress. So when things get so intensely stressful that the person is unable to cope, the mind goes through a fundamental change. It shuts down functions. It's like your mind is going zzzz, and then it's like zzzz. And they say it's actually like trying to protect. See, you know, when people have had traumatic experiences, sometimes they don't remember them for years and years, and they have a kind of a undercurrent of tension. And then later they might remember things that caused these traumatic experiences, and they might say, well, you know, why did I hide this from myself? But your unconscious mind is always trying to protect you in a spirit of love and concern. See, so at the heart of yourself, there's something that loves you very much, and it wants you to wake up. Now, you know, in the Western world, people call this God, right? They say this is good. But in Zen, we say, if you imagine it as something separate from yourself, you're already recreating the problem. It's not in heaven. It's at the heart of your consciousness. There's something that loves you very much, that wants you to wake up. And it's taking care of you day and night. See, this is a Buddha nature, right? This is like a fundamental intelligence, you know. Or you could say your collective unconscious. Or you could say we say big mind. Okay. So Zen is all about learning to trust the process as it's unfolding, the process of events as they're unfolding. Everything is helping me to wake up. Everything is helping me to say this to yourself every day, it's not a lie, and it will help you. And if you trust yourself, you know, there is a kind of intelligence, a fundamental intelligence, which is trying all the time to protect you, and it loves you, and it wants you to be awake. And it's not always 100% successful, you know, but it's always trying, and it does its best, you know. So, you know, when people are traumatized, you know, maybe, I've talked about this, there was a guy I knew who was a narcoleptic. He came into our Zendo, and his father used to beat him up. It sounds incredible and impossible that such a person could be in the world, but his father used to beat him up and hang him upside down in the closet. So his father was a deeply disturbed person. And this guy used to, under stress, go to sleep. This was his true nature's protecting him. And you could say, well, it's not much of a protection. He falls asleep under stress, but he's still alive. You know, this is really important. The mind protected him, like putting hands over him. And so there's something inside yourself which cares about you deeply and which is protecting you all the time. And learning how to access this deep self is a part of Zen practice, okay? Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said all sentient beings have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, it doesn't have to be clear, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I call him, hey you. If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, I said, not only is there active consciousness, boundless and unclear, they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. And it's very good. Guishan said, good. It's very good. Very good to be alive. Better than people possibly imagine.